We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The 2021 NFL Draft is officially behind us, and that's a good thing because I know that some of you haven't been going outside and getting the sweet, sweet oxygen and vitamin D that you should be getting. And how do I know this? You've been trapped in your basement and you've been on the computer or on your phone sending me these crazy mock drafts from PFF or the Draft Network, and none of those scenarios actually ended up happening. I don't know who the Chargers took, but it probably wasn't anyone you projected to them, because that's Tom Telesco. Anyway, now that you can go outside again, you need to shave that beard off your face, or you need to shave your grundle down there. Whatever you need to do because you've been ignoring your hygiene is that you want to go to manscaped.com and use code GUILTY for 20% off your first purchase. Again, that's manscaped.com and use code GUILTY for 20% off your first purchase. It's on us. At least 20% of it is on us. 80% of it will be on you. But fix your hygiene and stop sending me your mock drafts. At least I get a reprieve for 8 months. And you get a reprieve for my shitty draft takes, too. Oh my god, you guys are going to start sending me your 2022 mock drafts, aren't you?
Hey, Chargers fans, welcome into the Guilty as Charged podcast. My name is Steven. I'm your host. Got a fun show planned for you guys. We're going to have a great interview with Brendan Sinone later on in the episode. I was able to chat with him about the two players from Florida State. Technically, Trey McKitty did play at Florida State as well. So talking to him about Asante Samuel Jr. and Trey McKitty. And then we're kind of just going to go over some of the remnants from the draft. You know, kind of some of the takeaways that we've been able to have from, you know, kind of sitting on the draft, and then, you know, just getting into some general takes of things we got right, things we got wrong in terms of, you know, the league in general. So we'll get all of that started. But first and foremost, my guys here, Tyler and Alex. Tyler, we'll start with you. How are you doing today, man?
I'm doing very, very well, but I really have this itch to just swear throughout this entire podcast. Don't quite know why, but I'm feeling it. I'll try to keep it at bay, though.
I appreciate that. Alex, how are you doing today, dude?
Doing pretty fucking good today. but, you know, it's a pretty good day, and just excited to start the show.
Well done, sir. Well done. So first and foremost, we do have some unfortunate news to talk about, and that is Casey Hayward signing with the Las Vegas Raiders, much to the chagrin of everyone on Chargers Twitter. It was kind of predictable, right? Once Gus Bradley left there, we kind of assumed that, you know, some of the former Chargers players would go there. You know, they reportedly went after Rayshon Jenkins, and then Rayshon ended up getting a huge bag from the Jacksonville Jaguars. So right now it looks like they just have Casey Hayward, but, Alex, what's your kind of takeaway from the Raiders signing Casey Hayward?
I mean, it makes a lot of sense for them. And Casey Hayward might be their best corner right now at this current moment. Trayvon Mullen has shown moments of kind of development. He had a good September, but then kind of fell off the rest of the year. And Damon Arnett, who was their first-round pick in 2020, is currently kind of unplayable. So, like, they want some more development out of him. They bring in Hayward to kind of stabilize the group, pretty much be a bridge corner. So, I wasn't too surprised by Casey's decision to go there and also the familiarity with Gus Bradley, of course. As for how much better it makes them, I mean, you know, I don't feel like it makes them that much better just because, you know, Casey had a rough year last year, and usually when corners hit that bad season after 30, they don't usually have a rebound year. I wouldn't say that it's impossible because Hayward was hurt last year, and maybe this year he's luckier with his health, but I think it's more of a stabilizing move for the Raiders than it is a, you know, ceiling-raising move for the secondary.
It's amazing how fast their secondary has potentially, we don't know how the rookies will be, has started to turn over. Before, it was certainly a weakness. I still think it's a weakness. But, you know, if you want to be Gus Bradley and only rush four, which he's going to try to do despite their personnel, you know, at least have some good guys on the back end. And, you know, a guy you know, like guy, like you said, is probably their best, like, DB on the team. I like Merrick a lot, but I want to see what he does on the field first.
Right.
So it's a good spot for him. A lot of fans are bagging on him for his picture where he looked miserable. I personally didn't think he looked miserable. I just thought he was trying to make, like, a I look like hot shit face, and it just looked like he was kind of like he's not good at it. You know, so
just poorly executed picture.
Poorly executed, yeah. I think he legitimately did not try to look like, you know, super miserable. But no one really looks good in silver and black anyway.
That is true. That is 100% true. It's definitely a little disappointing. But, you know, I think obviously players look at – they don't look at rivalries the same way that we do, right? And so Casey's looking at this as kind of his last hurrah. He gets to reunite with Ron Miles, and Gus Bradley, coaches who he's very familiar with and have done a lot for his career. So it sucks. I'm not going to, like, wish him well, but I'm not going to root against him either. You know, there was a lot of, like, oh, I can't wait to see Jalen Guyton burn him. And it's like, okay, like, that's a little – I'm not vibing with that one. I definitely don't want to see him have his best game against the Chargers, but I'm definitely not rooting for him to fail miserably against the Chargers either. So, you know, kind of an expected move once everything kind of settled. They apparently were trying to figure out if they could get Richard Sherman first and then settled on Casey Hayward. So we'll have to see. But I'm not, like, super worried about it like Alex was saying.
And neither are we.
Cool. So the other thing that I kind of wanted to talk about today before we get into some of the other stuff, I did go back and watch some tape on Chris Rump from his 2019 season, and I no longer think that that was the worst pick of the Chargers draft. And, you know, watching that tape, I can see some traits, some workability that Brandon Staley could look at and say, all right, I can work with this. I can, you know, maybe mold him into something, you know, beyond that. But I'm still concerned. Like, I'm not going to get to the point where, you know, I'm going to outright praise the pick as, like, my favorite day three pick or somebody that I think is going to have, you know, an instant impact. But I can see some traits, some workability. And so I just wanted to clarify that. I know I was kind of hard on the pick last time or on our last episode. So I just wanted to clarify, I no longer think that it was the worst pick of the draft, but I am still, you know, a little concerned with what they're getting in terms of, you know, the lack of strength of the power of attack and the lack of bend around the corners. But I'm a little more on board than I was last time.
I see.
Hey, yeah, Rump, very cool. Now, what do you think is the worst pick of the draft?
Well, it's a tough question, right, because – I really like the player, but to me, it has to be Trey McKitty because I think the value at that point is the worst value of the draft. And I'm not as low on Larry Rountree as Alex is. I actually do really like him there. And it's a 6-round running back, so who freaking cares at that point? But Trey McKitty really, really
Can we talk about how Brandon Staley said he wanted to pick him earlier? Because that reminded me of Anthony Lynn saying he wanted to take Joshua Kelly in the third round.
Yeah.
Not to say that, you know, Staley's going to be Lynn, but, you know, the whole overvaluing running backs thing is a tad concerning.
Yeah, that was a little concerning. But, yeah, just from a value standpoint, I think it has to be Trey McKitty, unfortunately, because I do really like the player. But it just kind of seems like looking back on it that they had their eye on Tommy Tremble and then Tommy Tremble went, I think it was like 7 picks before them. And then it was like, oh, shit, we got to grab our blocking tight end. So that's just kind of my perception of it. But, again, I do really like the player.
I mean, I still think Roundtree's the worst pick of the draft. But then you say it's a sixth-round guy and it was your second sixth-round pick. So, like, I guess it is McKitty. As far as Rumpf goes, that's such a hard one. I've never found a player that I think is just so difficult. Maybe because he's on the Chargers now and I really have to think about it. Yeah. Whereas Sean Wade, it's like, great 2019. Horrendous 2020, therefore I can just be like, eh, I don't like him. But now Rumpf is on the team, so I'm trying to think of what he does well. Personally, like, I see what he did well in 2019, and he does that in 2020. He's a good inside pass rusher, either as an edge guy working inside against a tackle or standing up and working against a guard and rushing on the inside. But, like, he still isn't good against the run in the UNC game. He still gets blown off the ball in that game. He doesn't really have a whole lot of pass rush arsenal on the outside. So the concerns are definitely still there. And then, I mean, spoiler alert for the video breakdown I'm going to do. Between his reps against Banks, Eichenberg, and Darisaw, I think he won, like, one rep out of, like, 30.
Yeah.
So, and those are, you know, guys that are draftable and good tackles or guards. So we'll see. We'll see about him. But, yeah, definitely not the worst pick in the draft. Congratulations on, you know, watching film, being mature about it, and being able to change your stance on these things. That's more than I can say about most of Chargers Twitter.
Thank you. I will say, like, he's, aside from the strength and the frame, which he definitely has to fill into, I never saw any kind of counters towards the outside from him. And every single time he tries to rush and counter towards the inside, and that's not going to fly in the NFL. That's not going to fly when you're trying to counter inside and there's Quentin Nelson. So, you know, as Melvin Ingram found out, you know, a couple of years ago. So, or even, you know, going up against someone like Creed Humphrey, like that's not going to fly. Landon Dickerson. So him trying to counter inside every single time is not going to go very well for him. So like I said, I still don't see like a super bendy, twitchy athlete. You know, he's going to have to figure out how to make an impact on the outside. He's not going to be able to rush against guards every single rep like Duke had him doing against North Carolina, which was fun. It was entertaining, but it was also infuriating because I'm like, I want to see this edge rusher rush from the edge. Stop having him rush against the guards. So there's definitely a lot of things that he's going to have to work on. But, you know, we said on Sunday, you know, you see glimpses of it. And I think in 2019, the glimpses are more frequent. And so that's kind of my thought process is here is I'm like, okay, I can see more of things happening, which is weird because he was more productive in 2020. But you know, Tyler and I were having this conversation. A lot of his production in 2020 was, you know, rushing against guards and doing stunts where he's looping from one guard all the way around to the opposite side. So there, like I said, there's definitely a little more upside there than I initially thought. But I'm still a little concerned. They're still not ready to, like, you know, if he's playing 20 snaps a game, I'm concerned. But if he's playing 5-6 snaps as a rotational pass rusher, playing on special teams as a rookie, developing, filling out his frame, then I think that's okay.
I just wonder how much, when we look at, like, this college season in general, of these players were affected by, like, is the season happening? Is it not happening? Both mentally, physically, right? You know, like, I mean, the Pac-12 really didn't know what was happening till the buzzer. The SEC and ACC were sort of, like, always kind of going on, but then, you know, they canceled and didn't, you know, whatever. But so I don't know. I wonder about that, looking at like a player's performance declining when we talk about like Sean Wade, like Tyler mentioned, or potentially Chris Rumpf, like that's something that just sticks in my mind.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, we'll have to ask, like, I don't know, like you've got to ask these players if they really felt like they were affected by it or not. So interesting thing to keep an eye on. The other thing we wanted to talk about before getting into this interview is just kind of, you know, we did our draft grades, right? And all three of us gave an A- to the Chargers. And they're getting a lot of praise for what they did this weekend. And I think, you know, there is definitely some frustration on Chargers Twitter about, you know, the day three picks. And, you know, we are all kind of in agreement about at least, you know, the Roundtree pick not making a whole lot of sense. But you look at, you know, Pro Football Focus giving the Chargers like the third best draft overall, and like CBS Sports is like the fourth, and Mel Kiper gave them an A. So it's a little interesting that like there's this outside perception of the Chargers nailed it, the Chargers did awesome. And then you log on to Twitter, you search, you know, Dan Wolkenstein, you pull up that thread, and everybody's just banging on the Chargers picks on Chargers Twitter. So I guess, you know, Tyler, what's your kind of takeaway of the thought process of, you know, nationally it looks great, and then on Chargers Twitter, you know, there's a lot of mixed emotions there.
I think I would have been part of that crowd, honestly, that was a little bit on the more negative side in years past. I know, like, we're covering them on Bolt Beat and now here, like, you've had to do a little bit more homework, so you're able to kind of, like, settle down, don't react to the pick immediately and figure things out. But, you know, I think I would have been negative on it, but I'm being completely honest, like, your perspective on someone like Brendan Hymus or Josh Palmer or Nick Neiman, you know, some of these guys, and even Trey McKitty, you know, whether we talk about it on the podcast or not, or on Twitter or not, I'm pretty sure that the three of us have DM'd about pretty much every player that we could possibly think of that the Chargers could take, might fit here, whatever. You know, so interacting with you guys, and you know, all three of us have watched a certain amount of players, but, you know, Steven had, you know, the Palmer and McKitty thing a little bit more, I think. That makes me, I think, a little bit more positive. So I think, you know, based on – okay, so, like, that thread was wild to me because I saw – like, to me, I was more measured with the picks because you had talked about these players. And, you know, and of course, Brendan Thorne talks about, you know, Hymus. And it's like, okay, I'm going to trust these opinions, and that's why I think these picks are okay. But it seemed like for a while there that fans were like, okay, I don't know who this person is, so I don't like them. But then, like, the next morning, everyone's going – I've kind of softened on this a little bit. I've kind of grown to like these picks because I get it. Maybe it's not the best player. Maybe it's not the safety that they needed, but I like the player, and Staley wanted him, and Staley has a vision. You hear it through Telesco, through Staley, you know, through the interviews or whatever. You know, Staley had a vision for it. He wanted these guys. So I think people are starting to warm up to that. But as far as that thread went, I don't know what happened because even the thread question is just, you know, do you like the draft overall? And people are like, no, I don't like their third round, you know, third round pick. And I was like, I don't think you kind of missed the whole point of the thing. So it is a little bit, wild. I don't know. Maybe there's a more vocal majority than I completely missed the first time around, but it seems like people were down and then they're back up. And then based on that thread, we're kind of somewhere in the middle now. So not really sure what's going on.
Yeah. I think the thing is that you just can't weigh every pick evenly. Like, you can't just put, you know, Rashawn Slater, you know, all the way down to Mark Webb and just weigh all those picks evenly because they're not all equally important. And that's why I think you see some of the national media be like, well, they got Rashawn Slater. They answered their question at left tackle. They, you know, got Asante Samuel. They answered their question at cornerback. And then after that point, you know, a lot of it is about depth. So, you know, you may get an analyst that's like, I don't know about Chris Rumpf, but, you know, they nailed, you know, everything else in those first three rounds, right? So that, I think, is part of it, whereas, you know, Chargers fans in comparison are more, I guess, they might be more entitled to just be like, oh, well, I like this pick, don't like this pick. Right, you know, and I'm guilty of that too. I mean, I was kind of doing that on Saturday, to be fully honest, you know, when it just came to day three. And I think with more casual fans, there definitely is like, well, I know this player and I don't know this player. So therefore that this pick is bad, right? Versus, you know, how many of us knew who, you know, Antonio Gates was as an undrafted free agent who played basketball, right? Like, and then he turns out to be an all-time great, right? So I do think they're just as like, well, you know, everybody's watched maybe, I don't know if everybody's watched, but everybody's heard of like probably 100 different guys. And then if, you know, in the field of 250, if they take a guy that you're not familiar with, then the instant reaction is to be sort of negative about it. So I definitely think that plays into it when we talk about like Chargers Twitter or something. But no, as far as the national media, I mean, I think the national media just looks at it as they filled all their major needs. They got the players they wanted. And, you know, that's kind of it. That kind of is what it is. I think they were third on Dane Brugler's, like, you know, combination of all of the grades. Yeah. And I think that makes sense. You know, I gave them an A-, and despite not liking all of their day three picks, like we talked about, like they just did such a great job on day one and two, and you know, the day three picks matter less, right? So that's where I see the side of the national media, but I also do see the side of Chargers Twitter of not loving every day three pick for sure.
Yeah, I think it's definitely normal to criticize what the Chargers have done, and you know, we've been able to have that kind of balance, you know, where we talk about Rashawn Slater and Asante Samuel Jr., but then we also, you know, take a step back and criticize some of the other picks. And I think it's normal that you don't love every pick, especially when you have 9 draft picks. And so, you know, you're going to get an Elohi Gilman and a Larry Roundtree essentially every single draft just because of the sheer volume of players that are entering the league. So I think it's totally normal to say, hey, I don't like this pick. I don't get it. You know, obviously all 3 of us talked about our, you know, our least favorite picks, but like Alex said, it's tough for me to sit back and look at someone and say, I hated their Larry Roundtree pick, so I hate the draft as a whole. And it's like, well, there were 8 other picks. Like, you've got to be able to have that balance. And, you know, I think a lot of teams approach the draft very differently on day 3, where some teams will try and take a swing on someone like Trey Smith, right? You know, who carries this huge medical risk, but the talent is so, so high. Other teams, like the Chargers, will target players who they know that can contribute on special teams, and if they develop into more than that, great. If not, they're a 7th-round pick. They're a 6th-round pick. And so Alex kind of pointed it out that, you know, the 2017 draft class for the Chargers, you have Mike Williams and you have Rashawn Jenkins who are getting extensions or, you know, are going to be able to have long-term futures, but then you have a guy like Sam Tevy that's, you know, on a different team, and Isaac Rochelle that's on a different team, and they signed a 1-year deal. So the reality of the NFL is that most of these day 3 picks are probably not getting second contracts. And so if you get some special teams value from them, if you do hit on them, then it turns into a great pick.
Right. And, you know, people talk about like the concept of bad drafts too. Like, oh, well, the 2017 draft is explainable because Telesco is a bad drafter. But I also link that Chiefs one from 2017 where they have Mahomes, they have Tanoa Passenio, and they have Kareem Hunt in the first 3 rounds. And it's like they nailed it. But, you know, Kareem Hunt, for not off the field reasons, is on a different team. Yeah. Tanoa Passenio signed with the Saints. And 3 of the other guys that they took aren't in the league anymore. Like, and Mahomes, it's a win because they took Mahomes and he's the best quarterback in the NFL. Like, you know, so I think there's that part of it. As far as like the draft picks and liking them kind of thing, like, I don't expect to like every draft pick. I'm not Tom Telesco and I'm not Brandon Staley. Like, unless I'm running the team, I'm not going to like every draft pick. And if I ran a team, it would probably be trash. I would probably take a receiver in the 2nd round and go crazy with it.
Bro, you would have taken Hamza Nathalie at 90. You would have taken Hamza at 77, bro.
Yeah, I probably would have. And point that, like, I just don't think anyone is like above criticism either, because a lot of people in the YouTube comments of our last video were like, oh, well, you gotta, you know, get time for the Staley vision and it's too early to criticize them. It's like, nah, like, I knew Trey Pipkins was a bad pick at the time and I'm gonna criticize them when they make a bad pick now. Yeah. You know, like, I don't care if you're Tom Telesco or you're Bill Belichick. Like, if I like something, I like something, and if I don't like something, I'm gonna criticize it. You know, Bill Belichick pulled one of his best cornerbacks off the field in the Super Bowl, and also doesn't know how to draft a receiver. So to me, no one is above criticism, but also, you know, we shouldn't short people of praise just because, oh, you know, Asante Samuel Jr. fell into their lap or Rashawn Slater fell into their lap, you know?
Yeah.
Any other thoughts there, Tyler?
No, not really.
Okay. I think the bottom line, though, like we talked about last time, if Rashawn Slater and Asante Samuel Jr. turn out to be the kind of players that we all believe that they can be, then people are going to look back on this draft and be like, damn, they got a true cornerback one, they got a franchise left tackle, and if that's the case, then that's an A-plus draft, and that's that's all everybody's going to remember. So we're going to get to this interview right now with Brendan Sonone from 247 Sports, Knowles 247. Had a great conversation with him about Asante Samuel Jr. and Trey McKitty, so as always, if you're watching us on YouTube, that's going to be in a different clip. If you're listening to this on a podcast platform, that's going to start right now.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The economy is made up of real people doing real stuff, and it affects everything. Which you obviously know since you're a real person doing real stuff. Marketplace is here to help you get smart about everything beyond the what of today's business and economic news. We dig into the how and the why with the real people driving our economy. From big tech and interest rates to small businesses and what's happening at the Fed, Marketplace breaks it all down so you don't have to. Listen to Marketplace wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, Chargers fans, welcome back to the Guilty as Charged podcast. I'm so happy to be joined by Brendan Sonone, who covers the Florida State Seminoles, who obviously the Chargers have a budding connection with the Seminoles with all the players recently coming in. So Brendan, covers the Florida State Seminoles for 247 Sports, does a wonderful job there. Brendan, how are you doing today, man?
I'm doing well, Stephen. Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's an honor to be here and be talking about, I guess, FSU West, which is the Chargers these days.
Yeah, it's been obviously a lot of great fun having Derwin James on the roster, and then they got Gabe Neighbors as an undrafted free agent, and then this year they really drafted two really great players that I'm really excited about, in Asante Samuel Jr. and Trey McKitty. Trey McKitty obviously finished his career at Georgia, but I wanted to get Brendan's thoughts on his career at Florida State. So, just in general, before we dive into both of these players, what was your reaction when the Chargers drafted Asante Samuel Jr. with the 47th overall pick this year?
So my initial thought was one that's really great value, because I'm a big draft nerd and I have my own big board and I scout hundreds of guys just for fun is what I do in the off season. So yeah. I had Asante as a top 30 prospect or so, and I wasn't sure if he was going to go in the first round because, and I'm sure we'll talk about it, but his size limitations and being 5'10", about a 185, he doesn't fit the prototype in that regard. So I thought maybe with all these mock drafts having him go in the first round, that was a little generous, but in terms of the caliber of player he is, I thought, okay, once he got past the 40 range, I'm like, okay, this will be the time where we should see him. And we start getting to the late 40s, and I start getting a little nervous for Asante, to be honest. I wasn't really sure, okay, is there a big drop coming? But then obviously the Chargers come in at 47 overall, Stephen, my thought was, that's legitimately really good value for him, for a player 100%. Of his caliber at that spot, yeah.
Yeah, I'm so excited for them. We were talking before this, the Chargers getting Rashawn Slater in the first round, Asante Samuel in the second round, mm-hmm. It could not have gone better for them. I think the Chargers surprised a lot of people when they took Trey McKitty with their second, third round pick at 97. What was your reaction there when they did make that selection?
Yeah, I thought that was a little early just based on, again, what all the pundits were saying. And Trey McKitty had a nice career at Florida State and some of the metrics at Georgia. And I obviously lost, some track of him when he transferred from FSU to Georgia, but he was dinged up early on at Georgia and didn't play the full season. The metrics were pretty good for him. He was efficient, but didn't have huge numbers. So I thought that would maybe suppress his draft stock. But obviously the Chargers feel like they saw something different in him and saw a complete tight end. So I thought it was maybe a round or two earlier than what I was expecting, but Trey, we'll talk about it. Trey has some tools to work with as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm excited about him as well. So let's dive into the, who these players are, because I think, we see them, most recently, and that's kind of, what NFL fans are looking at it is who they were in 2020. What do you remember about Asante Samuel Jr.'s recruiting process? Obviously, he brought, you know, the name recognition, the pedigree to, you know, the recruiting process. So why did he choose Florida State, and what was kind of the reaction to him signing with the Seminoles?
Yeah, he was a big-time commitment. He was a big-time recruit. He was a top 100 guy or so wire to wire. I think he finished like 60th. Nationally in the 2018 recruiting class in the 24/7 Sports composite rankings. And I remember at the time myself and my colleague Chris Knee we did a podcast at the time when he had, I think he had committed or when the final rankings come out. But we were trying to talk about, like, didn't think there was like 60 players better than him in the country. We honestly thought that was a little low. We thought he was more of like a top 40 type of player and a borderline five-star. The big hindrance on him then as a recruit is the same thing now in the NFL. It's the size. That's really the only consistent knock you'll get on him before you start getting nitpicky. He was shorter. I think in high school he was about 165 pounds. So we're talking about thin, but he was, I mean, obviously he had the name with his dad being Asante Samuel. And the one thing that was consistent, he played in South Florida. He played at St. Thomas Aquinas, which is a powerhouse in Fort Lauderdale. I mean, you go ahead and pull up NFL rosters, you will find, without looking too far, someone from St. Thomas Aquinas, especially at that point. They were just rolling them out. So he was a really good player. I had a really good program, was also really good in like the 7-on-7 scenes and off-season stuff too, because he was a competitor. People call him a dog, and he called himself like an alpha dog. Like, that's something that he took pride in. I remember when he committed to Florida State, he committed under Jimbo Fisher's regime. Jimbo Fisher ends up leaving for Texas A&M. Willie Taggart comes in. They have to re-recruit him basically because I think it was Miami and some other schools were going in on Asante Samuel Jr. because he's a good player and you're trying to get that vulnerability, right? That FSU leaves the door open there. Yeah. But FSU holds on to him. Willie Taggart did a really good job kind of re-recruiting him. But Harlan Barnett, the defensive coordinator at the time, told when he got Asante there for an official visit, the first thing he told Asante Samuel Jr., he's like, I like the look in your eyes. Like, you look mad. And Asante, Harlan's credit, Asante always played that way. Like, Asante plays with a chip on his shoulder. He plays pissed off. I don't know entirely why, if it's just the size thing, if it's like, hey, I play the same position as my dad and have the same name and has that going for him. I've always felt like that's been kind of it. But, yeah, he was a big deal at the time when he committed to Florida State, and they were lucky to hold on to him.
Was there ever any doubt that he was going to end up at Florida State? Like, what was that crystal ball process like for him?
I'm trying to recall. I think it wasn't a super dramatic recruitment until Jimbo Fisher left, and then that opened the door.
Okay.
But Florida State did well to kind of close it in quickly, and I think they got him in on the early signing period, so it wasn't this long, drawn-out one. For whatever reason, I don't know if he grew up a Florida State fan, but despite getting some push from Miami and some other schools, like, it wasn't this really like, Trey, we'll get into Trey McKitty's, I'm sure, but like, his process was a little bit more dramatic than Asante's. Asante's was pretty straightforward as a recruiting process.
Okay, so what was, you know, more dramatic about Trey McKitty? Because as far as I know, you know, I didn't know who Trey McKitty was until he was at Georgia. So what was that process like for him?
So he was a high-end three-star recruit. Trying to think. So he was coveted by a handful of schools. Miami was always in the mix for him. Florida State was always in the mix for him. And he went to Bradenton. He's from Tampa area. But went to Bradenton IMG Academy, which IMG Academy is another powerhouse. It's not a private school. I'm trying to think of how to describe it. But it's basically, it's just a pipeline for.
It's a football school.
yeah, that's exactly what it is. They play sports there at IMG Academy. It's what they do. It's like where this is where all the great athletes go and for all different sports. It's immaculate facilities. So Trey McKitty went there, and he commits to Oregon in the summer ahead of his senior year. And I think he did it while he was like at one of the opening events or whatnot. And I remember there being some controversy at the time that his parents like weren't super thrilled with it. They wanted to get out there. They didn't want him to be all the way across the country. He's a Florida kid. They didn't want him to go literally across the country.
Yeah.
Ironic now that he's playing for the Chargers, but
yeah, he could have been catching passes from Justin Herbert in college. And now he's going to do it from the NFL.
I didn't even think of that. I didn't even think of that. Yeah. Funny how life works out. But yeah. So he's committed to Oregon for several months, and Florida State never really stops recruiting him. That was the guy that they wanted, they targeted. They liked his potential as a pro-style tight end because, yeah, he was more regarded as an athlete in high school, as a more athletic tight end, but they saw some potential as someone who could be a good inline blocker as well. He's serviceable for what Jimbo Fisher liked to do. So they kept recruiting him. Now, interesting that, that Willie Taggart ends up taking over at Oregon at the end of the season, like in December.
Oh my gosh.
So he gets hired. Willie Taggart had a connection to Trey McKitty because Willie Taggart was at USF Tampa, and I think Willie Taggart was his first offer at USF. And really, I mean, McKitty liked the idea of, like, okay, it's going to be a spread offense, and I could be used as a H-back, a slight slot wide receiver, still do some inline blocking and stuff like that. But ultimately, the distance was the factor for Trey McKitty. The parents were just, like, not comfortable with it, and at the end of the day, they get him back. Florida State gets him, and it was kind of like a long rumor, like, hey, it's probably going to happen. It does happen during the early signing period. FSU gets him. And then, again, talking about ironic, then end up Willie Taggart a year later ends up coming to Florida State. Remember Willie making a joke, being like, good thing you didn't burn any bridges, you know, the way you left. And so, yeah, it was an interesting recruitment for Trey McKitty, but FSU was really happy they got him at the time. That was one they put a lot of time into.
Man, life really went full circle on various fronts for Trey McKitty there.
Trey McKitty. And one little tidbit on Trey McKitty, too, because he's going – I'll tie this one, so he's going to have to fly cross country a lot. He's either getting his pilot's license or has gotten it. He's a different –
Whoa.
Different, more cerebral type of guy, very thoughtful. So not your typical, like, just head in the dirt football player. He's very balanced. So yeah, he's working on getting his pilot's license as well. He may have already gotten it at this point.
Wow, there we go. Some great info from Brendan here. You mentioned, you know, the I don't want to say dramatic process of the Florida State coaching staff. I don't know if that's an accurate way to say that.
It's been a dramatic few years, man. It's fine. It's been a bit of a cluster in Tallahassee. I think that's fair.
So you mentioned how that kind of impacted Asante Samuel Jr. How did you see him handling that process? How did you see him grow as a person, as, you know, a human being, as a young kid throughout his 3 years at Florida State?
So Asante, to me, was – so in 3 years, so he gets to Florida State in 2018. That's the first year of the Willie Taggart era. Again, it wasn't the coach he initially committed to, but he stays committed to Florida State. Harlan Barnett comes from Michigan State and runs this cover four press scheme that Asante, even though doesn't have the optimal size for, like the way he plays, the physicality, the footwork that he brings, like that's fine. They can work with all of those things. Things like Darquez Dennard was maybe like 5'11 or so, if I'm not mistaken, and did really well at Michigan State. So they like, we could work with this. So he steps in pretty early on, doesn't start, but gets thrown to the fire and has some really like big rookie moments, like learning curve stuff where in a closely contested game against Miami, that was pivotal for FSU that season. And they end up squandering like a 20-point lead. He gets picked on a couple times against Lawrence Cager, who's like 6'6" and kind of a jump ball specialist. Why Asante Samuel's isolated two plays in a row in the red zone against Lawrence Cager, I don't know, but he defends the first one well. The second one, again, just like physics, like you're not going to be able to defend that no matter how good your technique is all the time. They give a touchdown there. And then Asante also had a costly penalty on a blocked field goal, and I can't remember the game, but it was, again, he was trying to be aggressive. He's over-aggressive, gets a run into the kicker call, if I recall correctly. And that ended up being a big moment, swing moment in that game. So Asante kind of takes his lumps as a true freshman, gives up, I think, 6 touchdowns. So, but he wasn't bad by any means. You could see the potential was there. I think people were really high on him. It just, there was a true freshman that was thrown into the fire. Year two comes around. He establishes a starting spot for himself, but it's a different scheme kind of. They bring in Harlan Barnett's the defensive coordinator, but then they bring in Jim Leavitt like 2 or 3 weeks into the season. It's like a shadow defensive coordinator. It's a really weird deal. It's a different scheme. FSU's trying to do all this weird hybrid stuff that wasn't what Harlan Barnett was brought in to do. So, and then, you know, Asante has a really good season in year two, very I think the touchdowns gets cut down from like 6 to 3, gets a couple interceptions, just more confident, clearly like stable, consistent, and kind of a port in the storm where there wasn't a whole lot of consistency on that defense or in the program. And then year three, a new coaching staff, a new scheme with Adam Fowler, a lot more man coverage, which Asante really thrived in. And again, the touchdowns go down, I think, from either 3 or 2 to 1. He only allowed 1 this year per PFF. So he got consistently better every year, and he handled his business. I think that's the one thing, Steven, that was really, really stood out to me, was that they never had to push him particularly like hard, because he was always the one kind of setting the tone. Remember Mike Norvell talking about early on in preseason camp, there was one day where he did have to kind of get after Asante a little bit, but it was almost more like just to see what Asante would do and respond to it. And Sante just kind of looked at him and was like, I got you. And Norvell loved it. Like, and I'm sure Norvell talked about Asante really glowingly during the pre-draft process to teams, because Asante was just someone in a locker room that was hesitant and skeptical to buy into another coach and Mike Norvell, and all that was pretty well documented that Norvell had some issues in year one with guys trusting him and a lot of turnover. Asante wasn't one of those issues. He was someone who bought in right away, just handled his business. I remember after the Georgia Tech game in the opener of 2020 season, you know, FSU loses. It was inexplicably so. It was just like kind of like, oh, here we go again. They start off strong. There's a, they march down the field on their opening drive, score a touchdown. Offense looks sharp. And then there's like a 30-minute, 40-minute rain delay. And then another one. And all of a sudden, like, they come back out and they're just flat and they lose that game. Asante Samuel had two interceptions that game. I remember walking back to the parking garage afterwards, and Asante Samuel was in his car and just kind of like driving by smiling. You could tell he wasn't like down. He wasn't happy with himself either. He was just really content. You could just tell that was someone who just went and handled his business that day and knew he left it on the field and did what he could. And I just, that always struck me as like, that just seemed like Asante's demeanor, just really even keeled, kind of content with what he was doing. And just someone who, again, like, did what he was supposed to do consistently. That's how I remember Asante and his growth and who he was at FSU.
That's fantastic insight. And I've always said this, I think one of the most important aspects of playing the cornerback position in the NFL is being able to stay even keeled and be who you are every single week, every single quarter, regardless of, you know, what's going on around you. So that's great stuff. What was college like for Trey McKitty? Because you mentioned him as a cerebral guy, you know, getting his pilot license. So what kind of growth did you see from Trey over his years at Florida State?
Yeah, so Trey comes in as a true freshman, and it's the 2017 season, and that's Jimbo Fisher's last year. It's a weird year. It starts off with DeAndre Francois tearing his ACL and all sorts of ligaments in his knee in that season opener against Alabama. And it's just billed as, like, the opener of the century or whatever. It's one Alabama versus three FSU. And FSU has a chance to go ahead early in that game and go into halftime, and there's a penalty that's not called, and lo and behold, Alabama just pulls away and does what Alabama does. DeAndre Francois gets hurt at the end of the game. And after that, man, the season kind of turns into a cluster. There's a hurricane that creates a delay, and all of a sudden FSU's playing James Blackman, who's a true freshman who was not supposed to play until, like, his redshirt sophomore year or so. And he's playing 2 or 3 years at it. He's like 165 pounds, 6'5" quarterback. Like, he's – it was just a bad situation. So Trey McKitty ends up getting some burn later in this year. I think he ends up, I'm pulling up the numbers now. He gets 91 snaps. So he plays a little bit as a true freshman, shows some good signs, actually, like as a receiver and as a blocker, and shows some promise. It's just a weird year to really judge all these young guys who are playing, because Jimbo ends up leaving, and it was just this weird environment all around the program. Next year, Trey McKitty jumps into a full-time role under Willie Taggart and his lethal simplicity offense of being a full-time guy. He plays 663 snaps. So he goes from 91 to 600.
It's a big jump.
For sure. And a new scheme, not the scheme he was necessarily recruited for. And they use him all over the place. So sometimes he's an inline tight end. Sometimes he's more in the backfield as like an H-back. The offensive line, by the way, is awful this year. It's maybe the worst in college football. He's power five. They were atrocious in 2018. And he was also in the slot a lot as well. So they use him all over the place. He was productive, but just not super efficient, especially as a blocker. It just never really kind of materialized for him. You'd see these little signs where he would make some nice plays either like after the catch or get in the open field and make some nice moves. You see all the athleticism, just never really puts it all together. And then 2019, he has a new offensive coordinator. It's Kendall Briles. It's a similar system to what Willie Taggart was utilizing before, but not quite the same. So again, this is a guy going, talk about just weird program here, three different offensive schemes in 3 different years for Trey McKitty. He has a good year. He's solid, but they have to leave him back a lot to block because the offensive line is still an issue. They use him and Gabe Neighbors as blockers quite a bit. And really, they put Trey McKitty in some bad situations where he's having like an ISO on defensive ends a lot. And it's just not optimal for his skill set. So to me, it was someone like he was. Oh, and also in that 2019 season, Chargers fans can Google this if they want. There was this like mini quote unquote controversy where Trey McKitty standing in the wrong direction.
Oh,
have you seen this?
I've seen it. I've seen the picture of it. I didn't know it was him, but I remember seeing the picture going like, what the hell is going on down in Florida State?
It was a huge deal. It was just like another like, oh, this is just not what FSU needs kind of deal. They don't look like they know what they're doing. It was so overblown because basically when – with Kendall Browell's scheme, it's like with this tempo they're running, this crazy, crazy tempo, and you can go ahead and you line up in a spot and you can line up however you want, wherever you want. And then they like, well, then they'll get you into the right formation and you move. So it was like, it didn't impact the play. It didn't do anything negatively. The play was actually like, actually went for like a 9-yard gain too. So like, okay. but the frame of like Trey standing in this direction was like, people say like Trey didn't know what he's doing. The FSU didn't know what he's doing. It was kind of overblown. But so that was, to kind of point out just the meat grinder that Trey McKitty was in during his FSU career, I think that symbolizes it well. But Trey never really complained. He was always considered really kind of professional in how he handled himself and thoughtful, like I said, cerebral, and just solid, steady guy who I think didn't quite live up to what they wanted him to be. But, like, I wouldn't say it was a disappointment either. I'll say this, that when he left, the fan base was like, ah, good riddance. But they also said the same thing about Landon Dickerson. And that,
oh, geez.
Yeah. Oh, I died on that hill where I was like, yeah, you guys want Landon Dickerson. Like, no, if he doesn't want to be here, we don't want him. And I was like, all right. Like, I know he's injured a lot, but yeah. There were some cultural issues at FSU where they weren't maximizing some of their assets. But I will say this. When Trey McKitty left for Georgia and he transferred the new coaching staff, Mike Norvell's, they love utilizing tight ends. They get very creative with it, and they mix between pro-style concepts and a lot of RPO things and things that are going on in the NFL now. Norvell's been very cutting edge with, and he loves utilizing a couple tight ends at once still. Mm-hmm. They were upset when Trey McKitty left. They really wanted to keep him. That would have been a big feather in their cap, and I think to utilize him in their offense with Cam McDonald, who's very athletic, Trey would have been in line. He would have been able to move out some too, though. And a staff that I value Mike Norvell's ability to evaluate talent. I value that, and I think them seeing Trey McKitty as a loss at the time was something that stuck with me.
Well, I would be interested in hearing then if, I mean, obviously it seems like it has worked out for Trey, but I kind of wonder if he maybe regrets that decision because, I mean, he only had, I think, six catches this year at Georgia. So I kind of wonder what that process was like for him going from potentially an offense where he would have been featured to, you know, getting two or three targets a game if he was lucky.
It, like you said, it worked out. And that's, again, kind of why I was just surprised by the draft status of him, of where he went, because he was used so much as a blocker at Georgia. Now, apparently, like, yeah. I got the metrics in front of me, like his run block PFF grade is really good. It's 75.8 this past year at Georgia. I didn't watch a whole lot of Georgia football comparatively. He was between 45 and 58 in his 3 years at FSU previously. So I think having a better supporting cast, having better offensive line around to help out with blocking and more competency where you're not like in not playing in space and blocking in space to where you're being left to guard a tight end or a defensive end one-on-one. I think all that helped Trey because he can catch the ball. He can adjust to the ball very well. He's not super like flexible. Like he's not like this like kind of poetic in the air, adjust to the ball like Antonio Gates type, but he is solid, good hands, uses his body well, and good straight line speed too. Just not super wiggle, I guess, but the blocking was the big question on him. And I think the fact that he was able to do that at Georgia at a high level probably helps his draft stock at the end of the day. It certainly seems like it did.
Man, the whole experience for Trey McKitty, just all the full circles, you know, going to Georgia, but getting fewer targets, but improving as a blocker, just a fun journey to listen to about Trey McKitty. So we'll kind of wrap it up here. I think Chargers fans in general are very, very excited about Asante Samuel Jr. What do you think? I mean, we've kind of talked about his mentality. Mm-hmm. On the field, what do you think the Chargers are getting in Asante Samuel Jr.?
So I think the first thing is you're going to get someone who, one, super competitive, that is not going to back down. There's a clip that I put out in 2018, his freshman year, against A.J. Dillon. A.J. Dillon either gets a toss or gets a stretch concept. He gets outside the tackle box and he's in the open, starting to get in the open field. And Asante Samuel Jr. just closes in on A.J. Dillon. And there's about a 40 to 50 to maybe even 60-pound discrepancy between the two of them.
I was going to say, yeah, it might be lowballing it.
he missiles, yeah, because this is a true freshman, Trey, or Asante Samuel Jr., excuse me. So he has this hit probably like a 175 at the time. And he just missiles into AJ Dillon's legs, undercuts him. I mean, yeah, you take out anyone by the legs, that's going to work. But the fact he went in so fearlessly, didn't hesitate, got the tackle, that's a lasting memory of an Asante Samuel play that I think is quintessential Asante Samuel. That's what you get with him, is someone who's not going to back down. That doesn't mean he's always going to get the job done as a tackler. He does have the size restriction. But effort isn't going to be an issue for him. As far as coverage skills, like, he's really solid. Very quick feet, very technically sound there. I think he can be a little over-aggressive, a little handsy at times, but that's stuff you can kind of coach out a little bit. He also has the ability to play inside and play nickel, which I think is something that the Chargers GM have talked about too. They look at him as an outside-inside guy. But he can, make no mistake, like, he can play outside. That's what he did primarily at Florida State. They weren't always moving him into nickel. They wanted him on the opponent's best wide receiver quite often. So he's just really consistent, very steady. You know, I don't know if Asante Samuel Jr. ends up being a Pro Bowler or not. I would be shocked if he didn't have a 10-year career in the NFL, though. I think that he's a very safe prospect in that regard.
Yeah, I love that. And honestly, the Chargers need that. It's funny because I feel like the same way about Rashawn Slater, and that, you know, the two of them are very similar in what they'll bring to the Chargers, I think, in terms of consistency, flexibility, and versatility. So last one here, the Trey McKitty experience, I've learned, has been a wild ride in college. What do you think Chargers fans can look forward to getting out of Trey McKitty as a professional player?
Again, I think there's going to be a level of professionalism that he's going to bring to the organization. There's going to be some stability and some dependability there. So I do think there's a baseline of, like, if that's your tight end too consistently, I think you're going to be fine with that. Now, I'm not sure I'm sold on him becoming, like, your tight end one and eventually becoming a go-to guy there, like, for as a primary target, like how to use their tight end now. But I do think he's going to have a nice long NFL career as well. And I think the value of, like, if you think you can see growth of him as an inline blocker, which is how they're viewing him right now, and say, okay, he's going to do the dirty work for us, I think there's value there because there's still room to grow, but he has the frame, he has the willingness to do it, and he showed at Georgia, like, in that type of system and in a pro-style scheme, he can make that growth. But there's also passing production to be had with him as well. He's very quick to get downfield. Again, not super, like, yard after the catch, wiggly type of guy, a little tight-hipped, but good hands, good arm length, like, good catch radius there. So I think there's the potential for him to just be a really nice, consistent, high-end tight end two, if not like a low-end tight end one, if you have another good tight end to complement with. But obviously the Chargers currently okay at tight end. But he'll be a really nice complimentary piece, I think, for a long time.
Yeah, he landed in a great spot. Obviously the Chargers have a great track record with tight ends. Mm-hmm. They've got Jared Cook to take some pressure off of him, you know, initially. So I'm really excited to see how that pans out. Brendan, this has been awesome, man. I think Chargers fans and our listeners are going to be very happy with the kind of background information that they've been getting today from Brendan on behalf of Asante Samuel Jr. and Trey McKitty. So thank you so much for joining us, man. And if you are a Florida State Seminole fan or interested in learning more about this budding pipeline the Chargers have, make sure and give a follow to Brendan on Twitter at Beast Unknown on Twitter, and check him out on Knowles247. Thanks again, Brendan.
Oh, for sure. Thanks for having me.
All right. So thanks again to Brendan for taking the time out to join us. Some great nuggets there, including Trey McKitty has a pilot's license. You know, I think these college reporters have such a great insight into these players. They get to know them really well. And so I think having these kind of conversations is just so beneficial to all of our listeners and to us, because we get to learn more about them without being able to speak to them.
Yeah, and I think one of the early interviews that you did, I think Jason was there too, but at least you, was Yogi Roth about this Justin Herbert kid. And I think, you know, some of the questions that people had about his leadership and what kind of guy he was were really answered by Yogi Roth in that interview. And, of course, now you see that those issues were non-issues. Yeah. So having that kind of insight with these guys who know them really well is really, really cool. So I love interviews like this for sure.
All right, so we're going to move on now to just some kind of general takeaways from the draft, aside from the Chargers. And I think for me, like, the place that I wanted to start this conversation just in general was the safety class. I think, you know, all three of us were kind of on board with the top of this safety class being Trayvon Merrig. Obviously, you can include Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah there, but Trayvon Merrig, Richie Grant, Javon Holland, all three players that we really, really liked. And, you know, I'm sitting there each night writing an article for LAFB, and I'm like, man, there's so many good safeties on their board. There's so many good safeties on the board on each night. And the safeties just kept on falling. Like, Trayvon Merrig was looked at as a round one lock. He ends up being the third safety off the board. So, to me, that it just kind of shows that, you know, maybe the NFL and the player and the, you know, the front offices, they value things differently. And so the way that they valued this safety class, a bunch of them went in round four and five, but, you know, the safety position at every single turn was falling down the board. And so that was a position that stuck out to me and something that really surprised me last weekend.
I will say that I don't know how this trend continues past this, but last year, and again, I didn't grade these players, but the first safety was taken at 36, all in the second round. So Xavier McKinney, Kyle Duggar, Grant Delpit, Antoine Winfield, these guys that I'm pretty sure at least like three or two of them were, you know, regarded really as pretty good safety prospects. They fell. I don't know why they fell. I wasn't exactly in tune with that class. But I think this kind of, you know, the biggest thing for me is the injuries. And that's part of why these guys fell. Not all of them, but the things that came out about players that we didn't know about. Didn't know Morrig had a back issue. Didn't know Owusu-Koramoah had a heart issue. Yeah. Didn't know John Johnson had an arrest on his record. And so some of the things that pushed these guys back, didn't know about that. So I was surprised to see Holland going so early. But, you know, connect that to my next point, just in general, these play, like, I don't know if you felt this way last year, but it feels like this year to me, again, this is the only class kind of that I've graded. It feels like more guys fell because of things that I didn't know about than previous years. You know, right. Like why is Jenkins falling? Oh, he has a hip. You know, why is, you know, Trey Smith falling? Oh, he has blood clots. You know, why are some of these guys falling? One guy, you know, Weaver had an eventual, like, he was arrested, like, he was, like,
charged.
They filed the charge the day he was, they were charged, you know, the day that he was drafted. So, very, very kind of wild draft so far overall.
Yeah, I think that when you talk about the safeties, like, it's just, you know, there was talk about Trayvon Merrig maybe going in round one, right? But, you know, then we figure out he has an injury, and then you have six corners get drafted in round one, right? So it feels like teams were pretty clear about valuing that premier kind of playmaker, even though safeties can kind of do a little bit of everything. Maybe teams just kind of valued them this draft. But yeah, safeties definitely stuck out to me. Obviously, the stuff Tyler was talking about, like, hey, this guy might fall, all that. I was honestly surprised when it came down to the first round in particular, just how little trade action there was. Because we saw a lot of talk about the Patriots trading up, a lot of talk about the Chargers trading up. And then, you know, draft night comes and nothing really happened. I mean, not the Eagles trade up and screwed the Giants, which was awesome. But other than that, nothing was kind of a big mover in the first round, other than teams trading back for guys that they knew they could get, something the Raiders maybe should have done. Yeah. But, you know, I was just surprised there was a little bit less action than previously anticipated. But maybe that's just kind of a traditional thing that happens in these classes. But I actually think that Arjun said in his video the Chargers were, like, one of the only teams to not make a trade this entire draft, yeah. Which is very, very, very Telesco-esque, kind of very conservative and all that. But, I was definitely a little bit surprised by that. You know, I was a little bit surprised just by how much information was coming out now, as opposed to last year when it felt like we kind of still knew everything before the draft because of the combine, because of all that, like Brevin Jordan falling to round six or something like that. Like, I could not have predicted that before the draft. Like, I thought he was going third round latest. Like, that was sort of my opinion. And then, you know, they talk about his poor athletic testing in combination with some other issues. Like, you know, so that's something I was surprised by as well. Just not just the difference between so much the information we have, but also what the NFL's perception on these players was, particularly in the later rounds.
Did you see how many tight ends were drafted before Brevin Jordan?
No, I haven't.
There were eight. 8 tight ends drafted before Brevin Jordan, including that one from Ohio State that was like the blocking tight end.
Luke Farrell?
Yeah, wow. Luke Farrell went before him, man. Like that was one of the surprises of the draft. I think, obviously, I'm an offensive line guy, and we kind of knew going in that all these NFL teams were kind of all over the map in terms of offensive tackle rankings, interior offensive line rankings. But to see Walker Little go at pick 45, like, I know that, you know, Urban Meyer clearly had, like, a plan of drafting people that he recruited and had relationships with when they were high school juniors, which is just kind of a ridiculous way of going about the draft. But to see Walker Little and Jackson Carman go before Dylan Radunes and Creed Humphrey and Samuel Cosmi, like, to me, that was a surprise. The way that the offensive line class in general panned out was just really surprising to me. Obviously, you know, there's the Josh Myers thing, which I'm still just like shaking my head at. But the way in general, because like there was, I don't think there was a single person that had Jackson Carman coming off the board at 46. And, you know, we saw this thing from Duke Manyweather that teams were talking to Jackson Carman about playing tackle, and now the Bengals are going to play him at guard. And so it's like,
Really?
They're going to play him at guard, and they're going to stick Righty Rife at right tackle. So the way the offensive line class in general just really, really surprised me. Again, Brennan Hymus falling to the 5th round when, you know, he was kind of regarded as a top 12, 15 offensive tackle or swing option. That was a surprise as well, obviously.
There was also a lot of talk about, like, the opt-outs and the effect that that would have. And
none.
Sort of felt, yeah, it really none. Felt like it had no effect for most of the draft, just because they got to watch these guys tape and still evaluate them based on that. Now, I do think there's part of it where, like, maybe a round 4 guy becomes, like, a round 6 or 7 guy based on, like, opting out, but didn't affect Caleb Farley. Obviously did not affect Rashawn Slater and Penei Sewell, didn't affect a lot of the guys who went, you know, in the first 3-4 rounds of the class. I do think maybe that something happened with, like, Kerry Vincent, who was at one point, like, a 3rd, 4th round prospect, and then goes in round 7 because he opted out. So that's probably a thing. But, yeah, I was a little bit surprised about how much the opt-outs didn't matter just because of how old-fashioned NFL GMs are.
Right.
And how much they're like, I like that Jaylen Waddle played on a broken ankle, and I don't like that the other guys didn't want to play in this COVID season that we made up. you know, so I was a little bit surprised that that old man mentality didn't actually end up affecting it quite as much as people thought it did.
Yeah, definitely. The other two, well, the plenty of things we can talk about, but the two I want to talk about are Gregory Rousseau and Jason Owe. I'm trying to look at where Gregory Rousseau went, but it was 30-something.
31.
31? No, so the Ravens took Owe at 31.
Oh.
So he must have gone like 30 then.
Yeah, Bills. 30, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Bills, yeah.
So it's Peyton Turner at 28, Rousseau 30 yeah. to the Bills, Owe 31 to the Ravens, and then Joe Tryon to the Buccaneers at 32.
Yeah, Turner going early, Tryon kind of going early sort of makes sense. But, man, Owe going that early and basically be considered, not that they're two different teams, sure, but Owe being basically considered the same as Rousseau is a little bit off to me. I certainly would have rather taken someone like Rousseau. Like, about where Rousseau went is kind of, like, makes sense to me. He went, like, 30. I had him as, like, a 38th ranked player or something. So that's kind of, like, fair. You know, a guy who has so many traits, had a lot of production, but not a lot of, like, on-field pass rush sort of moves. That kind of made sense to me. But Owe going that early, like, Alex, I know you were, you know, you were kind of advocating for him, but certainly not at 31, right?
Yeah, no, not at 31. But I do think you see a team like the Ravens who is like, hey, this is our bread and butter. Like, we take these guys with high athletic skill sets, and we're going to develop them. We don't care what anybody thinks about the pick, and we're just going to, you know, go head on. Like, that's kind of what they do. And you know, you see that run on edges that was, right, Turner. Also Rosso, also Tryon, right? So, like, all those guys could go in that range to defensive, you know, teams that are looking to kind of build their defense a little bit out, but obviously still have very good defenses as it is already. So I think they were like, hey, you know, we can afford to take a chance. We're probably going to be in the playoffs next year anyway. And that's maybe how a team like the Ravens use Owe or how a team like the Bills use Rosso for sure.
Yeah, the Ravens, man, like, they're a winner like every single draft. Like the way that they draft, I know that they traded Orlando Brown, so they didn't really have a second round pick. But let me pull up their whole draft haul, because every time I look at the Ravens draft, I'm just like, man, these guys just know how to win the weekend. So they get obviously Rashad Bateman and Jason Owe, is his actual name, I guess. So then they get Ben Cleveland in round three, Tylan Wallace, the receiver from Oklahoma State, who I really liked in round four, Sean Wade in round five, which, not a huge fan of him, but that's good value. Dalen Hayes, the edge rusher from Notre Dame, and then Ben Mason, the fullback from Michigan. And like, I look at all of those picks and I'm like, okay, like, these guys are probably going to be really good for them and develop into some really good players. And, you know, I look at the way they attack the receiver position this year. You get a guy like Rashad Bateman who can separate over the middle. You get a guy like Tylan Wallace who can also separate, be a jump ball guy for Lamar Jackson. And I thought that they had a fantastic draft, kind of solving their issues like they always do.
Yeah, I mean, another team that I think was just super good at that same division is the Browns, where they just kind of retooled, reloaded, and, you know, now they have, you know, one of the best secondaries, I mean, in the league, and they also have Myles Garrett and Jadeveon Clowney, right, coming at you. So that, I think, is just, I mean, you know, kind of super insane to think about that they're going to be even better than they were last year in this attempt to make a run at the Chiefs and make a run at the Bills. Like, I think they put themselves, frankly, in that tier this weekend with all of the moves that they made. It's just crazy to see the haul that they got.
Yeah, Newsom, Owusu-Koramoah, Schwartz, Hudson, like, they were reading the minds of Chargers draft Twitter. Some of these guys, it's like...
Tony Fields.
Yeah, Tony Fields. What else from this draft stood out? I don't know. I'm glad that I called Nick Neiman in the sixth. Like, that was
awesome.
Ironic selection.
That was awesome.
Aleem McNeil over Shelvin makes sense. Oh, I just want to talk about, we talked about this before the show, Stephen, but Cameron Bynum not being a seventh rounder. That never made sense to me. That's why he was my pick almost every single time I got to the seventh round, because it did not make sense to me. I understand not like as a second round pick. But he ended up going in the fourth round or third round?
Yeah, he went early in the fourth, yeah.
Yeah, that's just about right to me. So I'm happy he went in a little bit earlier. Aaron Banks in the second was a little odd to me. Like, I understand that there's, you know, some good work there. And maybe like going in like the back end of the second. But he went pretty early, right? Before the Chargers picked, maybe?
Yeah, he was the Niners. I think it was – I can pull it up. But it was like in the high 30s.
Mm-hmm. Definitely didn't think Trey Smith was going to go all the way as far as he did. It's kind of a shame. Like, I still thought he would go back end of the third round. He went late. And, of course, he goes to the Chiefs and joins Humphrey. So that is going to absolutely work out in their favor. The Cowboys taking Parsons completely makes sense for all the reasons. Yeah. Deami Brown at 82. Like, he was like, Brentley Weissman on the show, or not on the show, but friend of the show, said, you know, he could go, like, he mocked the Brown to the Chargers. At 47, he went 82. That was a surprising fall to me as well.
I was just going to say, when you talk about like all the injuries, like Trey Smith and stuff, I wonder just not having the combine, not having all of that stuff, you know, probably that made teams be like, yeah, like if this guy is, you know, has this issue, he's just not on our board because we didn't get to meet him and we didn't get to do any of the stuff and our only interaction with him, you know, was on Zoom, right? So, for most of these teams and talking to guys. So I just feel like that was what made Trey Smith, you know, a third rounder to a sixth rounder, right? Or, you know, made another guy fall, right? Because, you know, if this was next year's draft where, you know, hopefully we have a combine next year and hopefully it's a normal draft process, I don't know if that happens because maybe a team feels more confident and it's like, yeah, I'll take Trey Smith in the fourth, right? Comparatively to what happened this year. So, I think the lack of information that teams have, and it was funny to see people in the YouTube comments be like, you guys don't have the information that Telesco and Staley have. It's like, this is actually the least information that Tom Telesco has ever had going into a draft, not just him, but all GMs in the NFL in general. So I think that having that little information and having that, you know, cloud of uncertainty certainly changed a few picks.
So, Tyler, to answer your question, Aaron Banks at 48th overall. So right after the Chargers took Asante Samuel Jr. Yep. Yeah, you know, Cameron Bynum, everybody knows how I felt about him. I was a huge, huge fan of his. I think he landed in a really good spot in Minnesota. You know, they have such a good reputation of developing, you know, defensive backs. And if he's able to kind of play that strong safety, you know, nickel linebacker, I think that would be a good spot for him. So, Tyler, any thoughts, any other thoughts before we wrap up today's show?
Just a quick thought. You know, at this point now, it depends on where the players went. So, like, yeah. I think Slater can have a better – not that the Chargers are really good at developing linemen, but, like, I think he could probably have a better career than Sewell in Detroit. And I think that Sertan's probably in a better spot with Denver than Horn. And I had Sewell higher.
Yeah.
I had Horn higher. But now it depends on where, you know, where guys go. So when everyone pulls up our big boards from this past year, in a year from now, remember that it's also about where they go. That's why Herbert won Rookie of the Year. Not that the coaching situation was all that great, but he had a lot of talent around him. So I'm really interested to see where these guys went and then how that plays into their development and, you know, whether we're right or wrong about these guys kind of based on their development.
Yeah, J.C. Horn to the Panthers was one of my least favorite landing spots.
Yeah.
You know, it made no sense because they play so much zone coverage, and that's not what you're drafting J.C. Horn to do, man. Like, so Horn to the Panthers, like, thank you, first of all. but also, like, it just didn't make any other sense to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would just say, like, the quarterbacks, right, like, all of that is just so much where do they end up? Like, is Justin Fields better off in Chicago than, you know, Zach Wilson is in New York? I have no idea because I do kind of trust Robert Saleh and the LaFleur brother over Matt Nagy at this point a little bit. So I don't know. Maybe that helps somebody like Zach Wilson. But also I do think Justin Fields obviously is more talented. And then, you know, it's kind of interesting. I was thinking about this the other day. People were kind of crushing the Broncos for not taking Justin Fields. And that's something that you can see in a year, 2 years from now, coming back to bite them in the ass, obviously, if Justin Fields is really good. But it got me thinking, if the Chargers had not taken Justin Herbert last year, and they did take Jedrick Wills or Isaiah Simmons, what would our immediate draft grade have been, higher or lower?
If they took
Isaiah Simmons or Jedrick Wills over Justin Herbert last year, I wasn't on the show, but would your guys' draft grade have been higher or lower than when they took Herbert?
I mean, I had a B+, so, I mean, to me, like, I liked that pick. It was the Joshua Kelly pick that really tanked that draft for me, and the losing the picks, like, that tanked the draft for me. It could have been higher. Of course, it depends on what they do after that, but, like, getting, if they had taken, like, Tristan Wirfs and got a freaking All-Pro, you know, even Love, like, the grade probably would have been higher because they needed a tackle. He would have been a good tackle. It was a good prospect. Would it have been higher? I mean, I gave it a B+ last year, so I don't know what I really don't know.
I was just asking that to say, like, you know, we didn't like Herbert last year, and then a year goes by, and we like Herbert now, right? Yeah. Obviously, and we wouldn't have changed that for the world. Mm-hmm. So, like, the Broncos passing on Sertan or on Fields will only come back to bite them in the ass if Fields is really good, right? And then, you know, that'll take place. But yeah, I was just thinking, like, immediately after the 2020 draft, if they took Simmons in comparison to if they took Herbert, I probably would have given it a slightly higher grade at the time. So yeah, it definitely is a factor of where these guys go, what weapons they have around them, especially when you're talking about the quarterbacks.
Yeah, I think I would have, you know, if they had gotten Jedrick Wills, I would have given them probably a higher grade, maybe a little bit. But, you know, the thing with taking a quarterback is that bumps up the value aspect of things. So the issue with the 2020 draft isn't who they took first, because I would have loved Jedrick Wills or Tristan Wirfs. The issue is what they did after that. So, which we've obviously seen now, you know, with, you know, Joshua Kelly being benched for Kalen Ballage and Kalen and KJ Hill and Joe Reed not being able to see the field. And so we'll have to see if anything of those players changes, but. You know, and the first round was not the problem for the Chargers last year. It was everything else that came after that. But yeah, and of course, if the Broncos end up trading Patrick Surtain for Aaron Rodgers, then I think that works out for them. But we'll have to cover that if there's anything else that happens. So, guys, thank you so much for tuning in today. As always, make sure and leave us a rating or a review and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Make sure, like I said, if you're watching us on YouTube, go check out the interview with Brendan Sonone. Some great content there. Can't thank him enough for joining us. And thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you guys next time.
The headlines remind us daily, the world is a dangerous place. The elites in charge say everything's fine, stop noticing, but you know better. And your gut knows that time is short to prepare for a world that is 4 missed meals away from chaos. My Patriot Supply has helped over 3 million families become more self-reliant and is the company Americans trust to prepare. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and secure their best-selling 3-month emergency food kits. Each contain delicious breakfasts, lunches, and dinners, averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Secure at least one food kit for each family member. For a limited time, save $200, plus get free shipping on all their Ready Hour 3-month emergency food kits. You're not ready if it's not Ready Hour Foods. My Patriot Supply also has solar power generators, water filtration units, biomass stoves, heirloom seeds, and critical survival gear. Shop MyPatriotSupply.com today. MyPatriotSupply.com.